and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Right now, you can go up there and get a great deal on a John Deere tractor, a mower, a implement. They got everything in stock. Go up and see them. If they don't have it, they've got several other stores they can draw from and get it in there and get it in time for Christmas. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can catch them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
Never gets old, does it?
No.
Okay. So, we're going to shift gears. We were talking about medicine in the first hour. Now we're going to talk about weather and climate and COP28 that you might have been hearing about in the news. We're going to find out what that's about. I kind of know already, but I got to tell you, I just want a spoiler alert. I am not playing the theme song. I was tempted. I thought about doing it. But then I thought, oh, man, I'm going to make a lot of people throw up. That would be terrible.
It was so wholesome. It was.
I had diabetes by the time I got done listening to it, and then I couldn't play it anymore. So we're going to be chatting with Dr. Judith Curry. She's president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. Imagine that. Weather prediction and predictability. How handy. I wish she could come work here. She is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. We've done a couple of shows with her, and I have listed those on the website. She had a terrific career until she, she got branded as a heretic.
Heretic.
That's a club we're proud to be in, and we have no skills, though, so we're not real heretics. We're armchair heretics. She's the real deal. She knows the science and knows that all this global hysteria is,
just that.
Hysteria.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Curry, rumor on the streets is that your email from a few days ago was where you thought you had nothing better to do. You might have something better to do today.
No, I'm I find that's a little bit scattered. Getting ready for my daughter's birthday dinner. I can take a 1 hour break to chat
good.
With you folks.
I was like, for God's sake, don't make us talk about the weather, because that's going to sound like, I could whistle, so we could do that.
I could look out the window.
There's that. Well, it's kind of funny, because I actually emailed her about doing the show this Sunday, because I realized that Dr. Kuby was an hour long, and I'm like, oh, man, we're going to have a whole hour. I looked out the window, and it was raining, and I said to myself, I should email Dr. Curry, because she knows about weather. Real weather, actually, not the fake stuff we keep talking about. So you had said we could talk about current weather, climate, and COP28, so that's what I called our show, but you can do whatever you want.
Oh, sure. I also want to mention my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Oh, gosh, yes, please.
Which provides a framework for thinking about this whole thing. But I'm happy to talk about whatever topics you think might
be. Yeah, we should talk. I have a I kind of didn't say that, but it's right here on the page for today. So let's see. Today is December 10th, 2023. And if you go to our webpage, I popped it right on there, and it's got her Twitter thing. Her website is judithcurry.com. And really easy. You don't have a tricky name. It's not spelled weird. Three cheers for your parents. CFANClimate.net, that's her business. And the book is Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. Imagine that. So let's just zoom right to that COP28 beeswax, because, they're not rethinking our response in a way that the rest of us would like.
Well, if we just get rid of cows, we'll be able to fix everything.
If we get rid of everything, actually, get rid of us, that would be good. But tell people, like, if COP28 is like, what? If that's a whole new term for them, can you...
This is the COP. COP stands for Conference of the Parties, and this is the parties to the UN Climate Agreement. including the Paris 2015 agreement, which most of the world's countries have signed on to, including the U.S. So every year or two, they have these big confabs. This year's is absolutely huge. I think there's over 100,000 people there, which is maybe three times the normal size of these conferences. And it's supposed to be for 2 weeks, but it shows no time, no sign of finishing because they really haven't accomplished very much.
Oh, that's a shock.
So there's still a lot of things on their plate. But it's interesting. It's being hosted, you know, in the Middle East, in the middle of oil country.
Yeah, because they're in Dubai, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
Where they all flew on their private planes?
Oh, exactly, exactly. The carbon footprint of this thing is absolutely enormous. So, you know, they go, what? We're supposed to stop using fossil fuels? No, we're not agreeing to that. You know, and so, you know, these are the hosts of the whole thing. And so people, there's all sorts of people there, including lobbyists and oil companies and wind turbine companies and battery turbine companies and activists and scientists. It's just an enormous group of people trying to accomplish what is not entirely clear. But they have these crazy deadlines, you know, about stopping emissions and temperature targets and whatever that are mostly made up in terms of deadlines or really political targets. And we don't show any sign of really meeting these emission targets. A couple of good things so far have come out. They've agreed that nuclear energy is now a good thing. Okay, it's now considered, I guess, green. So I think maybe 30 countries have signed on to this. And yeah, John Kerry in the U.S., who normally does, you know, very senseless things about climate change, he's been pushing nuclear energy now. I mean, even a year ago, nuclear energy was a no-go.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody.
Right.
We were shutting down the nuclear power plants in the U.S. and in countries in Europe and whatever. And now people realize, well, you know, nuclear is really fine. You know, it's just the Greenpeace-type organizations who hate nuclear along with everything else who, you know, have really pushed this anti-nuclear thing. But nuclear is a really good solution heading in, you know, deeper into the 21st century. So now that the fatwa against nuclear has been lifted, I think that's a really good sign. The other thing they're trying to accomplish, and they're calling it loss and damages. It used to be reparations, where, like, first world countries would reimburse developing world for all the damage that we've caused from fossil fuels. And the U.S. isn't buying it, although the Europeans seem to go along with it, but there's not much support for that. So they're calling it loss and damages. And that's complicated also because you have to attribute, you know, any losses or damages to global warming. So even if it's just weather or crumbling infrastructure or bad governance, you know, we have to blame it on CO2 emissions in order to get money from this fund. So that's sort of senseless. And hopefully they'll go back to the old days of maybe 10 years ago when it used to be development and foreign aid. We used to try to help underdeveloped countries develop their economies and, you know, provide some engineering support to improve their infrastructure and reduce their vulnerabilities to extreme weather events. I mean, that's what we used to do in the old days, trying to promote economic development. Now all of that kind of money has been subsumed into climate mitigation, you know, making countries green, even if they don't have any electricity at all.
Right, right. And the people are all starving and they're sick and they don't.
Right.
Yeah, they have no future, exactly. But you know what? It's green there. So right, that's right. Amazing.
And they regard burning dung and things like that for cooking as green because I guess it's renewable. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. So,
well, just out of curiosity, like, I remember, the first I remember about this was like in the 80s with Earth Day. And yes. I remember my kids were little, it had been early 80s, and I lived over on the coast where, you know, insanity reigns supreme. And it was like all about Earth Day. And they were telling the kids, you know, save all your cans and your newspapers, what we used to get back then. Save your newspapers and, you know, then recycle them. We're all going to bring them to school and recycle them. And they had these kids. It was like a cult. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it got really big in the 90s.
Yeah, in the 80s, it was kind of, well, it was kind of big over there because they sort of leaned that way. But I full disclosure, I waited till Earth Day and then I put my kids in the car and we loaded all that stuff up and we went to the dump and we threw it in the landfill. So I was like, there you go, kids, there's Earth Day for you.
You were a real activist.
I was a non-player at the outset. I was not destined to be a climate scientist or a true believer. But it's gotten much worse since then and much more of a... I mean, it's like a religion. It kind of reminds me of religion because they keep talking about how you have to believe in it.
Well, exactly. You know, and there's calling people deniers and heretics and there's a dogma. And, you know, and it's a secular religion, but it's even encroaching into real religion. The Pope has really gung-ho on this. I mean, there's even a papal academy of science, which is mostly focused on climate and environmental science, who advise the Pope, who makes these proclamations. So it's not just secular religion, it's real religion as well.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I don't remember ever taking a course in science in high school or college where I had to believe in things. Science was sort of always about bringing receipts, you know? Here's the proof. I didn't have to believe in it. It was right there in front of my face.
It's about data and, you know, labs and hypotheses and the scientific method and all this sort of thing. And now it's become, you know, some states have really been extremely aggressive about this, where they integrate climate into all aspects of the curriculum, you know, even math. And it's not in a science-y sort of way. It's more the impacts, you know, and it's the dangers of it. So it's really pretty bad. The NEA in the U.S. and all the teachers, like I don't have my acronyms right, but they're really activists in terms of pushing a climate curriculum, you know, in the K-12 education, and it's throughout all subjects, you know, really trying to build awareness and create young activists.
Yeah.
My daughter is in eighth grade, and so she told me that, I guess this was her English and literature teacher telling them, you know, all about Greta Thunberg and how she's making a difference and how important what she is doing and on it goes. And
yeah, that's...
The teacher was trying to elicit students, well, what can you do? And my granddaughter, who's eminently practical, he says, well, I need to go to school and learn a whole lot more about all this before I figure out what's going on and what kind of difference I might want to make in this regard. You know, so she wasn't going to buy.
So she's like a little heretic in training.
Because
that's not part of the True Believer anthem. Actually, I'm positive it isn't. We have to take a really quick break, but since we're not going to play the COP 23, 4, whatever it is, COP 28 theme song, I thought I would try to find some selections that maybe could be substituted for the COP28 theme song. Just some alternate possibilities we'll be playing this hour. And you are listening to Dr. Judith Curry. She is on with us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon, heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars. And we're narrowly missing the man in the moon, spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
Yes, apparently we have lost our way on the loony balloon, and a bunch of the loonies on the balloon are in Dubai right now. Along with a friend of ours, Debbie Bacigalupi. She's there. I don't think she's dressed like a pig this time, but the one time she went to those conferences, she dressed like a pig and followed Al Gore around the whole time. And she got a lot of satisfaction out of that. She sent me a text this morning that she went up to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and asked him if he was going to just eat bugs, when he was going to start eating bugs, and he shoved her, actually, and told her to get out of his face. I'm like, oh. Video.
So I'm curious, Dr. Curry. These countries that are participating in COP28, how many of them are actually moving their green energy agenda forward, or are they just giving lip service to it and actually still running coal power plants and realizing that, you know, this whole wind and electric thing just isn't working for them?
Okay, well, there's a few countries that are just blessed with natural resources, lots of hydropower and geothermal. Think Iceland, Norway, Costa Rica, a few countries like that. I mean, they've been almost 100% renewable for a long time. A lot of hydropower in Brazil, as long as they're not in a drought. Mm-hmm. So some countries just have naturally abundant.
Yeah, if your country's sitting on top of a volcano, I guess you got plenty of thermo, but most countries aren't.
Okay, so I think the most interesting case study is Germany, who had a pretty good mix, you know, like maybe 10 years ago. They had a pretty good mix of energy from nuclear, coal, natural gas. And then they wanted to go completely renewable. They went and shut down their nuclear plants and shut down their coal plants and imported natural gas from Russia. We know how that one turned out. And they were building all sorts of wind turbines and solar farms. And their electricity was really expensive. I mean, even with natural gas from Russia, their electricity was really expensive, and industry was, you know, starting to leave, and the power was intermittent. You know, once you get a lot of wind and solar, I mean, the wind doesn't always blow, and then you have to quick rush to make up the missing power with natural gas and fire up more burners and things like that. Okay, and so, of course, when they dropped all their nuclear after Fukushima, they said, okay, nuclear's a bad thing, let's get rid of nuclear. They had a lot of nuclear power. Okay, and then they, once the natural gas tap was turned off from Russia, then they fired back up their coal power plants using their own coal, which is really dirty. I mean, the coal in the U.S. is actually relatively clean. I think it's curtest and cleanest in the world. A lot of the coal in Europe is really dirty stuff. So the net result after Germans energy weaned, whatever they call it, is to be producing more emissions than they used to, largely because they have so much coal and they lost their nuclear and even natural gas. And they're competing, and now they want liquefied natural gas, which is transportable. But then they're competing with all sorts of other countries. Like Pakistan, they were told to go green, and so they, you know, not use coal, so they were relying on natural gas. They don't have pipelines, so they were shipping in liquefied natural gas. Now they have to compete price-wise with countries in Europe who want it, and it's too expensive for the Pakistanis. Okay, and so they're left in a bad place because they got rid of their coal and went natural gas, which they had to import, and now it's too expensive. So all of this has led to more expensive energy for sure, and certainly not cleaner energy because the coal is up. You know, the last couple of years, coal burning is really up. So, you know, we're not making progress, and then we've got all these unsightly and environmentally unsound wind turbines and solar farms that produce intermittent electricity. So we're not in a very good place. But even, you know, China is the most, you know, it's because it's so huge and they use so much energy, they've been installing an insane amount of wind and solar power. Insane amount. But then when you look at where their power comes from, it's only 7% from wind and solar, 82% from fossil fuel. You go, well, what the heck's going on? They're installing all this wind and solar plant. Well, the transmission operators aren't using the wind and solar. I mean, it's not dispatchable. You can't call it up when you need it. And it's too complicated to manage their electricity grids with the wind and solar. So they don't often actually use it. They just curtail it. So it's not being used. Wow. You know, so like, you know, like what kind of sense does this make? So the people who have gone wind and solar aren't generally too happy about it. In the U.S., Texas, they get between 20 and 30% of their electricity from wind and solar. And it's a real juggling act to balance, you know, when the wind and solar power aren't available, then they have to try to anticipate it and then make sure they have enough natural gas supply, and then they have to fire up the gas burners and their peak burners. And the management is really horrendously difficult. And the ERCOT, the Texas grid operators and power generators, you know, they're really good, but sometimes it's too much for them. In February of 2021, there was a really big cold spell, and the wind wasn't blowing, the natural gas lines were frozen, and they were, like, in a really big trouble.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, you remember that. And they were within minutes of crashing the whole system, you know, and having to go to a black start, which could take a couple weeks. Part of it was grid operator errors because they weren't, you know, managing, you know, the generation, the transmission, and the curtailment, and all this kind of stuff. But it's a horrendously challenging thing to do. You know, people are going to make mistakes under that kind of, you know. So they made some suboptimal decisions, but there was no, I mean, there was sort of crisis, but not catastrophe. So it's very difficult to manage. So I can understand why the Chinese just don't want to use it. I mean, it's just going to bring more problems that they, you know, don't want to deal with. I think there's a future for rooftop solar. I think there are some advancements that can be made in that technology, and people tend to like having some local control over their own power generation. So I think rooftop solar is probably a solution that will stick around. But, you know, 20, 30 years from now, I don't think we're going to be using wind turbines for power. other than in some niche locations. I mean, it just doesn't make sense given its intermittency, its land use requirements, the need for more extensive transmission lines, and really adverse ecosystem impacts. Farmers don't want the wind turbines on their land.
No.
A, because it dries out the soil and it prevents the soil from cooling down at night. So it changes the microclimate of the farm. They don't, wait a minute. We don't want to deal with this. I mean, and they're worried about, the resale value of their farmland if they have a wind turbine on it. So there's been so many proposals for wind farms that have been just canceled. I think that's over 600 in the U.S. wind farms that have just been canceled because of sort of not in my backyard kind of concerns, environmentalist concerns. And this isn't to mention all the ones waiting in the queue where the transmission grid operators can't really integrate it at this point. They need, it just can't easily be integrated. So it's sort of in the queue.
Part of it is it's not a dependable source. I mean, I would imagine that it just fluctuates up and down, which makes it very difficult to manage.
Absolutely. And it's not only is it intermittent, but it's asynchronous. This is a little bit of an engineering term. But you have to keep, like inertia. You have to keep the frequency. You just have to keep it moving. You just can't have things stop. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just that the need for, inertia in the power system, and it adds so much asynchronicity to it. It really makes it very difficult. So it's in addition to intermittency, you have this asynchronicity issue where it makes frequency control very difficult. So, I mean, it's not 21st century technology. Why are we doing this? Well, the reason we're doing it is because all of these urgencies, the deadlines, the code reds, highway to hell, and all this crazy rhetoric that you hear, we have to hurry up and do something. And, the cheapest, fastest thing to do is put up wind turbines and solar farms. But, it's not a good solution. It's really a step backwards. And it's really not helping on balance reduce CO2 emissions, because you have to back it up by natural gas. And when you're firing up and down these natural gas power plants, they're less efficient. And ramping it up and ramping it down, you're not really saving, preventing any CO2 emissions here, because you have to ramp up and down these gas power plants. Not only does it produce more emissions, it also produces wear and tear on the power plants. So they have to be replaced more frequently. And the blades on the wind turbines, after 10 years, they stop producing as much energy. So
they do?
They last 20, 25 years. Well, physically, yeah. But the degradation and the power that's produced really starts degrading after 10 years.
They get like dull from chopping up all the birds? Is that what's happening?
sort of, but they just don't work as well, or produce as much energy by quite a bit. And each year it drops down. And, this has to be factored in to figuring out how much power you're getting from your wind turbine. But people are saying, we really need to replace these every 10 to 15 years, huge turbines. If you've ever driven down a highway behind a truck that's carrying, some of these blades for wind turbines, they're absolutely huge. You don't realize it when you look up at them, because they're really high up, several hundred feet up. You don't really realize how big those turbine blades are. But when you see a truck carrying them, I mean, I was just astonished when I saw it.
No, we had a big wind farm here locally that was put in a few years back, and I saw those trucks, and I mean, they require highway closures and flaggers and everything else, and in a lot of the locations around here, you don't have like straight highways. You have mountain roads where you're trying to get these blades up in the hills, and they are huge. Negotiating the roads just to transport those, that's a big problem. But you know, solar has its issues as well. I mean, aside from the fact that the more solar they put up, the more expensive conventional energy is, because everybody that's still on the grid has to make up the difference in the amount of money that's the power companies aren't earning because customers are on solar. But solar, you know, is, unless you put in huge battery backups, when the power goes out, you don't have any power with solar. You have to put in these big battery banks to maintain your power. So, I mean, that technology is not all there either.
Okay. Well, the business model for electric utilities needs to be changed to accommodate solar in a sensible way.
Mm-hmm.
So the existing model doesn't work very well, and there's all sorts of conflicts, and I know there is in California for sure. The issue, I have solar panels on my house, and I have two Tesla power walls, and the price on those are coming down. So I think this is like a viable strategy. I mean, the bug, you know, it's still too expensive, and the electric utilities don't really have the right business model and the right pricing model. But I think those are things that can be overcome. So I still think that technology remains useful. I do it not for CO2 emissions, but just so I have energy security. So if
what a clever idea, huh? That's what we should be doing all of this for. I mean, that ought to be the goal,
exactly.
Right?
Well, you could do a propane tank. You know, the alternatives are
a propane tank.
Or the wind and solar and, batteries.
But just doing it all by itself is just, it's just not feasible for, like, cities and towns and, all right, we have to take a really quick break. Sorry, I was just going on a rant. I was going to go on a rant.
Hold the rant.
Found another song for COP28. Okay, that might be the theme song. I think I found it.
You lied to me. Yeah, there you go.
It's got a snazzy beat. I could see them all dancing up there in their fancy outfits. Honestly, you haven't lived until you've gone to the little, just do a little, I'll post it, the little search for the COP28 website, and the little song's right there on the front page. It is really, I can't get it out of my mind. I saw it last night before I went to bed. It was not probably my smartest idea. Freak show. So what?
Say what you mean.
Yes, freak show. So Dr. Curry, honestly, with all of this stuff, you do consulting work, you know, you write books, you've been a professor for a long time. We're not changing the weather, are we? Like, not to put too fine a point on it, but
okay.
With the technology we have currently, can we change the weather?
No. I mean, okay, humans do impact the climate. Both the CO2 emissions do have a tiny warming effect, but you know that doesn't really translate into bad weather. People's land use and the urban heat islands and all this kind of stuff that does modify their local climate and their local weather. It may, you know, rainfall may be heavier downstream of a city or something like that. So there are some, you know, impacts that we have on weather. We certainly can't control the weather or climate, but the weather, you know, is global ocean and atmospheric circulations, which we really have a minuscule impact on. So even, you know, people have been, we had a spike in global temperature this year. In February, it started warming, and by the end of May, it was really quite warm in the global oceans. And they stayed warm all summer and into the fall, and they seem to be coming back down a little bit. People think, oh my gosh, this is what the climate models have been predicting. Well, you know, I did an analysis of all the satellite data, the top of the atmosphere radiation balance, the energy balances at the surface winds. I did a big analysis of all this. And what was going on in 2023 was a lack of clouds. The cloudiness was really reduced in the northern hemisphere oceans, and the wind speeds were reduced also. And this was just sort of a fluke combination of circulation patterns, you know, that gave us that. And so with less cloudiness, more of the sunlight could get in and be absorbed by the Earth system. And the wind speeds were low, and that kept the ocean evaporation to a minimum and allowed the ocean surface to heat up. And that's what we saw in the northern hemisphere, you know, during last summer. And, you know, the combination of a number of things, we just came off three La Nina events, and we're starting an El Nino event. We had an unusual circulation pattern in the Atlantic. You know, so it was really natural climate variability that was producing all this. And actually the sign, and it had nothing to do with the CO2 emissions, because the sign of the radiation trend, the anomaly at the top of the atmosphere, is exactly the opposite of what you would expect from increasing CO2. It was really, you know, reflecting the signature from the clouds. So, I mean, that's a little bit technical, but the bottom line is this, all this record warming and whatever this year, it has really nothing to do with carbon dioxide. So, I mean, there's a lot of natural weather and climate variability that happens. Oh, the other thing that we're feeling, you know, a couple of years ago, there was the Hunga Tonga volcano. You may have heard about it. It was an underwater volcano that erupted, and it blew a lot of water vapor up into the stratosphere that has been circulating its way around. In the summer, you could really see the effects in the Antarctic in the southern hemisphere, their winter, and the water vapor has made it now to the northern polar regions in the stratosphere, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but that is definitely having an effect.
And that's nothing that we have any control
weather.
Over. I mean,
no, we have absolutely nothing to do with it. So it's a combination of Hunga Tonga volcano and the ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns. And we're also heading towards the solar, you know, the 11-year solar maximum. So that gives it a little bit of a boost. So this is natural. It had nothing to do with the slow creep of increasing CO2. So, you know, against the very large natural weather and climate variability, it's very hard to, you know, discern any kind of a signal from the CO2 increase. I mean, that's really just the slow creep. You know, slowly increasing sea level rise, slowly receding glaciers, that kind of thing. You know, it's not, you know, affecting the weather. You know, this year in the U.S., apart, you know, all these crazy stories about record high temperatures, but it's really been a very benign year for the U.S. There was only one landfalling hurricane that did not very much damage in Florida. That was Hurricane Idalia. there's been hardly any forest fires in California. I mean, the only big insurance claims have come from thunderstorm-type weather and some tornadoes. I mean, that's been the main, you know, insurance claims from bad weather in the U.S. this year. So in spite of these really warm temperatures, it wasn't, you know, a bad weather year for the U.S. at all. So, you know, there's just...
Yeah,
no,
so much for the hysteria. Well, swinging back to this idiotic deal in Dubai, is this just an excuse for a bunch of people to prance around and virtue signal, or do they really think they're getting something done?
Oh, people are trying to get an angle. I mean, there's companies there trying to cut deals. There's people there trying to influence policy. You know, people trying to make a buck, trying to have influence. You know, it's not this big meeting of altruistic wise people or whatever.
No,
you
know, just look at the cast of characters
for
that.
Money and power, you know. And there's a lot of sort of science-y. I know a number of scientists who've gone. You know, I see them talking on Twitter. Oh, I went to COP28. They're completely irrelevant at this point. You know, nobody's listening to the scientists. You know, that this has all developed a life of its own. And, you know, the last thing any of these people want to do is listen to some scientist. So,
says the scientist.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to listen to some scientist.
Yeah, so it's just a big confab. Huge number of people. I mean, just a huge number of people there.
Do they, how much, I know this isn't something that you can really exactly put a number on, but like, how much of an influence does that stuff really have?
I mean, at the end of the day, the UN is powerless. It only gets its power from, you know, national governments. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you've seen this is COP28. It means there have been 27 of these before them, and emissions still keep going up. I mean, and the only thing that we've done is slow down development of countries in Africa and, you know, put up a bunch of wind turbines and all that that aren't really reducing emissions on balance. So there's not very much that's been accomplished at the end of the day. I don't know why do they keep having them.
I mean, I'm asking you things you can't really answer. You know, I mean, I can't figure out why they keep having it. It's just because they all like going to these exotic places and looking like they're doing something, and then there's all the shoulder rubbing and the graft and all the rest of it. Is that just the whole? It's a wonderful excuse to do all that? Because that's what it looks like.
Nobody, people want to have a seat at the table, you know, if there's something big going on. So people, you know, like Trump, you know, took us out of the Paris Agreement. And then, of course, first thing Biden did was get us back in. it'd be interesting if Trump gets elected again. We'll see this happen again. But it's fairly meaningless either way. The U.S. has done much better than most countries in terms of reducing emissions, largely because we've replaced a lot of coal burning with natural gas. I mean, that's the single most significant thing that we've done. At the end of the day, the wind and solar aren't doing much on balance. So, you know, it's just, I mean, it really makes no sense. I mean, when we, you know, in the year 2100, when we're all doing really fine and the world will be much wealthier and healthier than it is now, and we look back on this period, you know, people will wonder, what the heck were they thinking?
yeah, hopefully they'll open the time capsule and just mock all of this stuff. They'll use it for comedy.
Well, there's always so much revisionist history that goes on. It'll be interesting to see how this gets whitewashed.
Yeah, then there's that.
Or greenwashed or whatever they do to it.
Well, I mean, even when you look at their, like, okay, here's just their little statement on their website's hilarious. It's COP28.com, so it's pretty easy for people to find. But it says, the UAE is a global hub and growth engine for sustainability, technology, business, commerce, and tourism. The country is uniquely positioned to build bridges and foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate progress. I'm sorry. Did that say anything?
No, it doesn't say anything. Oh, but of course. Oh, you mean we're supposed to, you know, get rid of oil and gas? No way.
But they don't say any of that. I mean, it's just this, la 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 la. We're going to foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate progress. What is foster consensus to accelerate inclusive climate? What's an inclusive climate progress? You're a climate scientist. Well, is that a thing?
It's a bunch of word salad, but they made it very clear that they're not interested in restricting fossil fuel production. I don't know. Okay, so if you can control the methane problem, natural gas is certainly better than coal. Oil, there's so many uses for oil. We'll be using oil probably forever. We probably won't be burning it for fuel much, you know, much past the 21st century, because I think it's too valuable just to burn it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are better ways to proceed. You know, we should be taking a step back. The thing we should be, the real tragedy of all this is energy and climate policy got coupled. Energy policy is so much more complex. You know, there are so many other factors at play, and like the environment is only one of the factors. And we should be stepping back and envision what we want our 21st energy infrastructure to look like. Yeah, sure, we want it to be clean, abundant, and cheap. You know, how do we get there? Well, nuclear is an obvious one, and we want to minimize land use and resource use overall. Again, a nuclear score is very high there. I mean, so we should just be stepping back and try to figure out, you know, what would we like this to look like, and then how do we get there? And we're going to need a lot of fossil fuels to get us there. We're going to make a transition, you know, to a better 21st century infrastructure, and trying to kneecap fossil fuels before we have anything to replace it with is just a recipe for economic and national security disaster.
Yeah, it's total lunacy. You can't just dump it without a plan. I mean, we have a lot of ideas, but we don't have a plan. You're absolutely right.
Well, they come up with all this stuff and all this happy talk, you know. They're going to reform land use, transform food systems. They're going to mobilize solutions for vulnerable countries, operationalize loss and damage, and deliver the most inclusive conference possible.
Okay, well, we need to talk about food. When you talk about climate change, you tend to talk about how it's doing.
Dr. Curry, you get to talk about food because you're going to plan a party. And I hate to say this, but we're getting cut off by the news.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to have to do this again on a different day, and we will be in touch with you, and thanks for helping us kneecap the ridiculous climate, lunacy.
Okay, thanks. This was fun.
It was super fun, and thanks for coming on with us again. You can find all this at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.